16. The blue pre-war Plymouth halted by the curb, and Ferdy Heinke hopped out and ran up the path and down the stairs and knocked on the door of the basement apartment. A light was on behind the shade of the living room window, and he knew either Rachel or Art was home. The door opened, and Rachel, looking wan and listless, said,
"Hi, Heinke."
Always shy in her presence, he scuffed his feet and said,
"What say? Is Art around?"
"No,"
she said.
"I sort of wanted to pick up the dummies."
She did not appear to understand, so he explained,
"The dummies for Phantasmagoria? They're around someplace. Art was working on them."
"Oh," she said, "yes. He asked me to go over the spelling."
She held the door open and Ferdy Heinke entered.
"I'll get them."
Ill at ease, he waited for her. The apartment had a deserted quality, a lack of life. While he was standing around, he realized that a man was sitting in the corner with his legs stuck out, a grown man in a suit. At first, he thought the man was asleep, and then he realized that the man was awake and looking at him.
"Hi,"
Ferdy Heinke murmured. The man said, "Hi, Ferdy." Recognizing Jim Briskin, he said,
"How are you?"
"Not so good," Jim Briskin said, and that was all. Rachel appeared with the dummies.
"Here,"
she said, giving them to Ferdy. Her tone was so weighed down that he decided not to stay. He accepted the dummies for his science fiction magazine, thanked her, and went off up the steps to the path. Behind him, Rachel shut the door of the apartment. He continued along the path, past the iron gate to the car. At the wheel, Joe Mantilla said,
"You didn't stay long, anyhow."
"He wasn't home,"
Ferdy said, getting into the car. They stopped at the lithograph shop, which was still open. The man behind the counter, fat and wearing suspenders and a colored shirt with the sleeves rolled up, inspected the dummies. His stubby fingers riffled the pages as Ferdy Heinke and Joe Mantilla stood circumspectly a short distance away.
"You want it folded and stapled, don't you?"
The man scratched estimates with a ballpoint pen.
"How many copies?"
Ferdy Heinke told him around 200, and the man wrote that down. He also wrote complicated figures about the number of pages, size of pages, and cryptic letters suggesting the weight of paper, the type of chemical process.
"Can we go look at how it works?"
Ferdy asked, interested, as always, in seeing printing processes.
"Sure,"
the man said, smoking a Malacrino cigarette.
"Just keep out of the way."
They wandered past the counter and saw the negatives of several dummies from local corporations, and then the actual photographing equipment. Next door was more interesting material. The Rube Goldberg folding and cutting machine was clanking away, and hundreds of pamphlets, all alike, were rattling down an inclined belt. The title of the pamphlet was "Tungsten in Time of War," and it was put out by a factory in South San Francisco. The pamphlets hung astraddle the moving belt, and at the bottom, they were mechanically collected into a pile. The room banged with the noise of the conveyor. Metal arms reached and groped.
"It looks like a Martian,"
Heinke said.
"Or like Abe Merritt's The Metal Monster. I have that in the original edition. It was published in the October 1927 issue of Science and Invention under the title The Metal Emperor."
"Yeah,"
Joe Mantilla said, not listening.
"Nobody hardly knows that," Heinke went on, above the uproar.
"Where was Art?" Joe Mantilla said.
"I don't know. He was out."
"If I was married to a girl like her," Joe Mantilla said, "I sure wouldn't be out."
"That's no lie,"
Ferdy Heinke said. They got their estimate and left the bindery. As they walked back to the car, Joe Mantilla noticed a flat manila folder under Heinke's arm.
"Didn't you give him that?"
"No,"
Heinke said.
"What is it?"
"A story,"
Heinke said, becoming instantly cautious.
"What kind of story?"
"Science fiction, of course. I wrote it all last week. It runs 500 words.
He clutched the folder with both hands.
"It's pretty good."
"Let's see it,"
Joe Mantilla said. An evasiveness crept over Heinke.
"No soap."
"What's it for?"
"I'm gonna submit it to Astounding."
If they print it, everybody'll read it.
Mantilla stuck out his hand.
Let's have it, come on.
Hanka stalled.
It stinks.
What's it called?
The Peeping Man.
What's that mean?
Hanka struggled.
That's the lead character. He's a mutant with psionic powers. He can see into alternate Earths. The whole world is destroyed and in ruins, and he sees Earths in which there was no war. It's not exactly original, but it has a new twist.
Joe Mantilla grabbed the folder from Hanka.
I'll give it back to you tomorrow. You can submit it then.
Give that back, you shit!
Hanka snatched it angrily.
Come on, goddamn you!
The two of them struggled, during which the folder was dropped, stepped on, picked up, dropped again. Joe Mantilla tripped Hanka, and Hanka fell sprawling, still trying to catch hold of his folder.
You...
Hanka yelled from the pavement.
Why don't you want me to see it?
Mantilla said, gathering up the crumpled sheets.
What's there that you don't want anybody to find out?
Sullenly, Hanka climbed to his feet.
When you show things to people you know, he brushed off his jeans, they always say it's about them.
Is it about me?
Hanka plodded along toward the car.
A writer has to gather his materials where he finds them.
Joe Mantilla gave him a swift kick in the rump.
If it's about me, I'll deball you.
And I'll sue you for assault and battery, and for theft of my manuscript. How about that?
As he got into the Plymouth, he said,
It's not about you.
Who then?
After a long time, Hanka muttered,
It's about Rachel.
Joe Mantilla snorted.
God damn, that's a laugh. You been thinking about her?
It's about her and art.
No kidding.
Seated behind the wheel, Joe Mantilla began to read the manuscript. The Peeping Man, a science fiction story by Ferdy R. Hanka. Colonel Throckmorton's glance turned involuntarily in the direction of the triple-locked chamber around which armed soldiers in uniform with blasters kept a 24-hour vigil. No man had gone into that room. Earth's last hope was in that room, and the door was sealed. What thoughts went through the colonel's head? There was no turning back. They had gone too far. The room contained Earth's one hope for salvation from the ruins to which the Third World War between Russia and America had brought it. It's eerie, the colonel trembled. Is he a demon or a god? Sometimes I don't know which. I tell you, Lieutenant, I haven't closed my eyes in sleep in days. I hesitate to trust the fate of mankind to that being. We know nothing about him, Lieutenant. How can Homo sapiens understand Homo superior? It's beyond comprehension. But perhaps he can save us. The lieutenant's voice was quiet as he spoke. If he wants to. In the room sat a man, head bowed. The man was thinking. His name, Ronald Manchester. He was 23 years old, and the psionic power within him had flowered at last to full bloom. But he was not thinking of that. He was thinking how he was the most powerful human in the world, yet not a human, but an incredibly unique godlike Superman who could save Earth. He was seeing past the mundane world in which ordinary man lived. He was seeing into an almost unbelievable other universe whose beauty was hidden to all save him. What did he see in that other universe? For to him, it was manifest alternate presence of other possible Earths that had not been wrecked by man's greed. They were inside his head. His mind was a space-time continuum that led from one Earth to the next, and his frontal lobe was trained on that miraculous salvation which he alone could see. Beautiful trees he saw, and flowers, a great garden very much similar to the Garden of Eden. It was unspoiled by greedy man. Animals lay down with other animals. People walked around in peace and friendship. There was no strife. Ron saw all this, and he was sad, for he knew that man had destroyed his own world. Would man destroy this veritable garden of paradise? The heart of the Superman was troubled. He knew the greed of Homo sapiens. He was the beginning of a new race who lacked that selfish greed. And he had been imprisoned by soldiers because they hated and didn't understand anything different. He had been chased by a howling mob of mass men. He had been stoned and thrown sticks at, beaten, troubled. He had at the end crept away from the haunts of man. He could not endure among them because he could not kill. He lacked the ability to destroy. He was like God. He loved everybody. He wanted to be friends. One day he was sitting alone in his cell, and he looked into a different other world of such breathtaking beauty that nobody could imagine it. Nobody could believe it existed. It was so fair and untouched. Even the man of tomorrow was stunned and for a time silent. He trembled and grew cold all over as his eyes made it out. A lovely forest pool rippled in the primeval glade. Animals besported themselves under mountains that rose against the sky. The sky was star-studded, and a moon of arresting beauty hung there beaming down. Suddenly he saw something, a shape moving among the trees. He looked more closely. He saw a woman. The woman was a goddess, a large cat-like lion whose fur was green instead of the usual was sitting with her at the edge of an untroubled forest pool. The woman stared reflectively down at the water and every now and then dabbled in it, sending ripples in ever-widening circles. The woman was nude. Her breasts rose in two cones that ended in pink roses that he saw with almost awe. On her face was a sad look, as if she was thinking. Then one day, just before they were going to come and shoot him, the beautiful woman appeared. A blazing circle of blinding light appeared in the center of the cell, and there was the woman. "Come," she whispered. Her eyes were large and blue, and her lips were red. Her hair was a cascade of black down her bare neck and shoulders. Her legs shone long and bare in the light of the flaming circle in which she moved. "I will save you," were the words her lovely lips formed. "I will lead you to a world in which you can live." "Why?" was the other's instant query. Colonel Peterson might possibly appear at any instant. "I have fallen in love with you. I know your plight, Superior Mutant, but hurry." She seemed to glance into the view screen attached to her bare wrist. "Soldiers are coming. If I'm to save you, I must as soon as possible." Their telepathic brains met, and he saw what he had to do. He shinnied up the wall to the light globe. From it, he took the platinum atomic filament, an invention of the future that operated without power. And ripping wires from the walls, he took his belt buckle and brought out the concealed microscopic tools he carried. He quickly made a machine under her telepathic direction. "Do you trust me?" her lips whispered. His rejoinder was, "Yes, my beloved. I trust you entirely, for you are not like the others. You are not like man." Suddenly, there was a blinding flash of light. When the light cleared, he was lying on a grassy glade he knew so well. At first, he couldn't believe he was there because something in the way the woman talked gave him grave doubts. He wondered if she was not telling him something. Then she appeared. She wore a simple, plain white robe looped at her waist. On her feet, she had sandals. The cloth seemed to cling to her breasts, which were full and upright. Her body moved as she walked. "You are here," she said calmly. The strange smile on her face had grown. She led him stumbling from the glade down to the edge of a mountain. The sun blazed down on them, and temporarily he was blinded. When he opened his eyes, what he saw was impossible. He cried out, but there she was beside him. She sensed and knew. For what he saw was that he was still on Earth. There was the ruined cities, all broken and ruined as he remembered them. It was the regular Earth. He was stunned. "This is your real world," the woman told him. She pointed with her bare arm out over the ruins at the foot of the mountain. "I have brought you back to it. I and you will rebuild together. We will not turn inward and shrink our terrible responsibility. We offer eternal hope to mankind, which deserves being rebuilt. With your ability and our money, we can help repair the damage bacteria and H-bombs did.
Millions have died horribly. War has taken a ghastly toll. But do not despair of men. It was the military, not all men. I am a woman, you a man. We will help man, not turn our backs on them.
He listened to her, and gradually a dawning discovery came to him. The point she was saying was this, that he had been wrong. He had taken the easy road, and the woman had helped him to see what he had to see.
And all the Colonel Peters? He asked. We have triumphed over them,
was the answer as she stood beside him on the mountaintop.
They are no more. The power of goodness and love finally won out over war.
Already, far below the two of them, the rebuilding had begun. They walked slowly to greet it.
End.
Joe Mantilla returned the manuscript and folder.
It sure is corny, he said.
He started up the Plymouth.
No good,
Ferdy Heinke agreed, discouraged.
Is that what you mean? You don't think I ought to submit it?
He knew in his own mind that the story was hopeless.
Was that Rachel?
Joe Mantilla said.
That goddess?
Yeah, he said.
I don't get the ending.
Ferdy Heinke said.
The idea is that she was really a human being and not from some other universe.
You mean, like a Martian?
A mutant. He thought she was a non-human mutant.
Is that supposed to be art? That whatever his name is?
It's based on art.
What's he supposed to be? A mutant like her?
That's what he found out, Ferdy Heinke said. He was a human being, too. His duty lay with mankind, not to himself. She showed him that. His duty was to rebuild the world.
After a while, Joe Mantilla said,
I sure wouldn't mind being married to her.
You can say that again, Ferdy Heinke said.
And you know, she's real smart.
Yeah,
he agreed. Joe Mantilla said,
What do you think the purpose of life is?
That's hard to say.
Well, what do you think?
You mean the ultimate purpose?
What we're here on Earth for.
Ferdy Heinke, pondering, said,
To help mankind evolve up the next step in evolution.
You think the next step is with us already, but we don't know it?
Maybe so, he said.
I used to think the purpose of life was to do God's will,
Joe Mantilla said.
How do you define God?
God made the universe.
Have you ever seen him?
Hey,
Joe Mantilla said.
I read this story where the military shoots down this angel, you know, and it's wounded or something.
He developed the plot for Ferdy Heinke's benefit, repeating the details endlessly.
I read that,
Ferdy Heinke said. Joe Mantilla said,
It's funny all the different things she knows. Rachel, I mean. Maybe she really is a superior mutant.
Gesturing, he went on.
I wouldn't be surprised to discover that she has those powers mutants have. I mean, she's not like anybody else. When she says something, you know it's right. Maybe she has that faculty of, what is it? Reading the future.
Precognition,
Ferdy Heinke said.
You think so?
No, he said. That was the whole point of the story. She's actually a human being, and there's really a lot of human beings not like the military.
If she was here now,
Joe Mantilla said,
and she heard us talking, you know what she'd do?
She'd laugh.
Yeah,
Joe Mantilla said.
You notice that most things, like what other people like you and I believe, she don't believe? When you talk to her, she doesn't even hear you. Like, all the different things we do, the organization and the beings from Earth. I think she really is a superior mutant, and after everybody else is gone, she'll take over the world.
Ferdy Heinke said,
I think this is the last dying days of our society, the way Rome went out.
Why did Rome fall?
Rome fell because their society became hollow, and then the barbarians swarmed in, and that was the end.
They burned all the libraries and buildings,
Joe Mantilla said.
Tough,
Ferdy Heinke said.
That was wrong. They killed all the Christians. They walled them up in the catacombs and set animals on them.
It was the Romans that did that, Ferdy Heinke said. In the gladiator fights. The Romans hated the Christians because they knew that the Christians would pull down their empty society, and they did.
The Emperor Constantine was a Christian, Joman Tilla disagreed. It was the barbarians who killed the Christians, not the Romans.
They argued indefinitely.